Good afternoon, members and members of the public. I call this Committee on Human Service Finance Committee to order. With that, we have a quorum present. I will move with the motion. Ben, do you want to move the approval for minutes for February 14, 2023?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the minutes for February 14, 2023.
Vice Chair Banner moves the approval for minutes for February 14, 2023. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the minutes for February 14, 2023 are now adopted. With that, members, we have two important bills. The first bill before us is House File 584. Representative Edelson, welcome to the committee. Please. Introduce a bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 584 seeks to increase MA reimbursement rates by 14% for home health aides and then 55% for the other professions, which include occupational therapy, occupational therapy assistants, physical therapy. It kind of goes on nurses as well. With this, members, at least four home health care agencies have closed in the last year. One of the most significant contributing factors to these closures has been the inability of organizations to hire and retain needed home care staff at the wage and benefits that support the level. MA reimbursement, essentially what we're coming down to is MA reimbursement is not the same as Medicaid reimbursement. We really want to try to get it closer to that. If we don't address this, really we're seeing people staying in hospitals longer, which is much more costly to our systems. And to be efficient in time, because I'm pretty sure all the testifiers here are not for my bill, I would like to go to my testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Edelson. I see the first testifier is Kathy Messerly.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Messerly, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Home Care Association. Our members provide hands-on care for approximately 40,000 older Minnesotans and people living with disabilities and complex health conditions in their homes. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 584, a bill aimed at increasing the access for more Minnesotans to have critical home care services. More and more home care agencies are limiting their services or, as Representative Edelson just indicated, actually closing their doors due to workforce shortages. This has led to more individuals turning to more intensive, expensive, and currently overly stressed hospitals and long-term care settings. It's a challenging cycle because then hospitals are unable to safely discharge the patients back to their homes due to a lack of available home care. The staff who provide the skilled nursing and related services in private homes, the most cost-effective setting, are underpaid and undervalued. With the demographic trend of fewer individuals in the workforce, we must do all we can to offer strong wages and benefits to those individuals who do step forward to provide critical home care services. Because legislatively set reimbursement rates heavily dictate the wage and benefit levels that are offered to staff providing medical assistance home care services, the legislature must act to allocate the investments required to implement these needed increases. This is all the more urgent with current legislative consideration of FMLA and sick and safe time. House File 584 calls for an increase for the medical assistance reimbursement rates for nursing, therapies, and home health aides to help address home care's current low wages. This increased reimbursement will help address the current lack of access to home care services. We realize it's going to take a multi-pronged approach. We are also working on other initiatives around workforce, which I'm going to keep it short for timing's sake, but happy to talk to with any of you about what we're doing. Our state can and must do better. The bill is a step in that direction. Thank you for your consideration of this critical need, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Messerly. The next person that I have is Camille Zander. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is Cami Ozender. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer with Pediatric Home Service. We are a pediatric comprehensive home care provider that provides high-tech medical equipment services and home care nursing services to children with medical complexity. I am speaking here today as a pediatric provider, but the challenges we're facing in workforce apply to all agencies, regardless of the age that we are serving. We know the workforce shortage is a theme of the legislative session, and all aspects are worthy of our innovation and our attention. Today, I ask that we shine a brighter light on the extraordinary impact of our most fragile populations and the remarkable nurses that care for them. I'd actually like to start by sharing testimony of a parent of one of the children that PHS cares for. Unfortunately, he's unable to join today because his family doesn't have access to a nurse. So I'll read his testimony for you. Thank you, Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to be heard on House File 584 and for allowing my testimony to be read. I apologize that I am unable to be there in person before you today. My inability to be there today is an unfortunate result of the very issue that these proposed bills address, closing the home care pay gap. My name is Jason Bennett, and I am the father of Ashlyn, an 18-year-old young woman who has severe disabilities. We are a blended family of four, living in North Mankato. I work as a detective for a police department. I have a bachelor's degree in law enforcement and a master's in public administration. I also serve on the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training, having been appointed by Governor Walz in 2019. We are a family of public servants. Ashlyn is currently a junior at Mankato East High School. In 2008, she was diagnosed with Rett syndrome. She is completely dependent on others for everything. To list all her cares would take much longer than the opportunity permits me today. But in short, Ashlyn requires an advanced hospital level of care 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just to be safe in her home. She is authorized to receive 24 hours a day of complex home nursing care, but due to the crisis, she is not receiving the care that she needs. To provide an example of how deeply this crisis affects our family, since January 1st, it has been about 8 weeks, or 47 days, or 1,128 hours. During that time, our nursing agency has been able to fill only 556 hours of Ashlyn's care. That is a fill rate of 49%. This is not an anomaly. This is our new normal. This leaves our family to try to fill in as Ashlyn's nurse, which we are not. We are essentially working two full-time jobs. We work our day jobs and then often come home and immediately have to care for Ashlyn at 5 p.m. and may have to cover until the nurse returns 14 hours later. I have almost no leave time left due to the shortage, and I must save all I can in the event of another missed nursing shift. When there is no nurse, we have no choice. There is nothing that can take a higher priority than Ashlyn's care. We must forego vacations, social activities, sleep, and frequently our jobs just to cover the shifts. We've even had discussions about whether one of us should leave our job to provide care for Ashlyn. Pediatric Home Service provides Ashlyn's in-home nursing care. They are an amazing company both to work with as a parent and from what I've heard from the nurses that work for them. But I know because of low payment rates, agencies like PHS are unable to recruit and retain nurses. The crux of the issue is that the rate that nurses can make in a hospital home, in a hospital environment while they provide ICU level care is at about 50% of what that nurse can practice or can earn practicing the same skill in a hospital-based setting. Over the years, we have lost many nurses to better paying hospital jobs. Very few stay in home care for more than a couple of years. This bill's 55% increase in payment rates makes a significant dent in that gap, but most certainly doesn't close it completely. But without it, the home care nursing shortage will only get worse. If the shortage continues, one or both of us may have to leave our jobs. We will not be able to be Ashlyn's parents. We will be her nurses. We will no longer be able to provide insurance coverage for our family. We will have no time to be a family. We will not be able to attend to the three other children under our care. There will be no quality of life to speak of for Ashlyn or our entire family. All our time, energy, and resources will be dedicated to attempting to provide the level of medical care that Ashlyn needs from a nurse. This will likely lead to more hospitalizations and certainly poor health outcomes for Ashlyn. It doesn't have to be this way. I know that this bill will not solve all the problems of the home care nursing shortage, but is a step in the right direction, and the time to act is now. This cannot wait any longer, and there can be no half measures. Things are only getting worse, and if we haven't reached it already, a breaking point is inevitable. I am happy to help in any way possible. Thank you for your time. I know there is a limitation on time. I'm happy to also answer your questions as a home care nursing agency as well.
Thank you so much, Ms. Zender, for your testimony. And also, if you can send it in, Jason's testimony. And thanks for sharing his story with us. And appreciate that. I would like to move the bill first. I know we went straight. We were so excited. So I will move House File 584 to be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, members, do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussions? Representative Hicks.
I'll be really quick. Thank you, Chair. And thank you for bringing this bill. I have lots of friends in the Parents of Kids with Disabilities group who have been really affected by the home care shortage. Parents whose children lived in pediatric centers for 6 to 9 months because they could not find adequate nursing staff, and their children required trachs and complex medical needs and ventilators. And so instead of having their 2-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 8-year-olds home with them where they could love on them and support them and know what's best for them, they lived in hospitals. Mm-hmm. And when you're 2 and you've lived in a hospital for 9 months, that's not good for anybody. Mm-hmm. And the nursing shortage is, home nursing shortage is significant for those families. And so I want to thank you for the work that you do at PHS. I know it's wonderful work. I've heard great things about the things you do. And I want to thank the author of the bill for bringing this as a priority to make sure that all people can live in the community mm-hmm. if they choose.
Thank you. Representative Zalesnica.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for testifying today. My question is, have you seen in your pediatric side of the home care, I'm familiar with the senior side, but on the pediatric side, have you seen an increase in the clients or however you want to refer to it, but from, you know, in the last 4 years, has there been an increase in the referrals that you have for children and pediatric groups at home, whether it's for all types of needs? I'm just curious if it's the same or if it's trending up or what you're seeing as a provider. Thank you.
Mr.
Chair Noor, members of the committee, yes, we have seen an increase in the number of children who require services. It's a beautiful thing. More of these children are being saved at birth and living into a very bright, vibrant adulthood, but they need a little help getting over the hump. So we are seeing a growing number of children, and we have less and less resources to care for them. I appreciate the comments around the hospitalization. We know that in 2016, we knew there was a workforce shortage, so we were part of a study that was conducted across the 4 major children's hospitals in the state of Minnesota. At that time, children were remaining in the hospital unnecessarily on average for 54 days because they didn't have nurses. We were able to work with one of the hospitals in 2021 to refresh that data. Now, on average, we're up to 90 days that children are remaining in a hospital medically ready for discharge, their parents ready to take their baby home, but they can't because they don't have a nurse.
Thank you. That's what I'm experiencing when I'm in the community. So I was wondering if you're seeing that from your perspective in your service area, but thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I don't see any further discussions from the members. Representative Edelson, did you have any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I asked for your support. I actually was an impacted family, and pediatric home services was just incredible. It really does. It's great, Representative Hicks, to when your kids can come home early from the hospital. So thank you for your support.
Thank you so much, Representative Edelson. I renew my motion that House File 584 to be laid over. So the bill is laid over. With that, members, we're moving to House File 2, and I just wanted to begin by informing the members of the public we may not be able to use any signs during the discussion. Everyone is passionate about this conversation, but also we will have a timer for those who are going to be testifying so that you are informed. We have 2 minutes for the testifiers after the bill presentation by the bill author. So with that, Chair Richardson, welcome to the committee. I move that House File 2 be re-referred to the Commerce Committee. With that, please introduce your bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2 would establish a state-paid family and medical leave program. Research consistently shows across race, ethnicity, gender, economic status, age, and political affiliation, there's overwhelming support for a comprehensive program to provide paid family and medical leave. Nationally, over 70% of small businesses and 84% of voters support. Currently, as a nation and as a state, we have an uneven safety net. And with that, there are many families who are falling through. And many of them are our most vulnerable Minnesotans, including disproportionately low-income workers, families of color, rural families, and women who are the least likely to have access to paid leave. As we are in human services, I want to spend some time grounding us in the human case for access to paid family and medical leave. Because at the foundation of this bill is a recognition of our shared humanity and the reality that all of us at some point will require care in our lifetime. Nationally, 3 in 5 private sector workers lack access to short-term disability. Among low-income workers, the numbers are even more stark. 80% of those in the bottom quarter of earnings and over 90% of those in the bottom tenth of earnings lack access to short-term disability insurance through their employers. Nationally, nearly 1 in 3 seriously ill workers lose their jobs or have to change jobs as a result of an illness. In Minnesota, the data shows that many who gave birth did not have access to paid leave to recover and care for their newborns. Between 2016 and 2020, 77%, the vast majority of pregnant people, worked in the state during their pregnancy, and nearly two-thirds took unpaid leave after giving birth. We have a system that those who are most able to afford to take an unpaid leave have access. And those who are the most vulnerable and don't have the ability to sustain themselves economically, they don't have access to paid leave. There are real people and families that are being harmed by the system design, because we know that families that have access to paid leave, they're healthier, they're more economically secure, and they're less likely to rely on public assistance. The research is clear. Access to paid leave contributes to healthy outcomes. It reduces low birth weight babies and preterm births. The Minnesota Task Force on Prematurity found an estimated annual cost of $371 million in the cost of care just for the first year of life for preterm babies. That figure did not include the indirect cost to parents and caregivers with emotional stress and time away from work. And I would also argue those costs are even higher today, as those numbers are from several years ago. The cost of hospitalization for immaturity or respiratory distress averages nearly $70,000. Furthermore, 32.6% of infant deaths in the state are related to preterm births. Access to paid leave reduces infant mortality. And make no mistake, there are significant costs as a state that we are bearing, as an estimated 350 infants die annually in the state. Access to paid leave provides additional health benefits related to immunization rates and well-child checkups. It increases breastfeeding duration, decreases hospitalizations, decreases risks of infections, diabetes, and sudden infant death syndrome. It reduces postpartum depression, and it also increases participation in the labor force. The reality is also that most child care centers will not accept infants until they're 6 weeks old, which can complicate decisions for families. Paid leave can help fight substance use disorder, including the rising threat of opioid use disorder, which costs our nation more than $740 billion annually. Lost wages from lack of access cost the U.S. economy $20.6 billion annually. And in Minnesota, we're losing about $900 million a year. Access to paid leave would also reduce long-term care costs nationally. More than $3.4 billion annually is lost. When our elders need short-term support and can avoid a nursing home stay, they need a caregiver. Expanding access to paid family and medical leave will not only save money, improve health outcomes, it will also change lives. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my author testifier to do a brief walkthrough of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. So to the first testifier on the bill is Deb Fitzpatrick. Welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Sorry. Attempting to get my PowerPoint up here. It's not, okay, thank you. Sorry. Thank you, Chair Neuer, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I'm the Director of Policy and Research at Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. In my prior role at the University of Minnesota, I led the research team that conducted Minnesota's design and implementation study, legislatively mandated design and implementation study under contract with DEED. I'm going to spend just a few minutes grounding the committee in the program structure at a high level. So House File 2 sets up a statewide publicly administered insurance program that is self-funded and sustainable over the long term through contributions from both workers and employers. It allows self-employed people and business owners to join the program and employers to provide a comparable program. Eligibility for the program is based on workforce participation, and healthcare providers certify the need for and length of most leaves. Much of the program is designed to build on Minnesota's successful unemployment insurance processes, as well as those in eight other states that have implemented programs. Among the design options, this one was chosen for a variety of reasons. I'll lift up just three today. First, it is a portable wage replacement benefit, which is especially important for workers and with multiple employers or those changing jobs. Second, it creates the broadest possible risk pool, a feature necessary for keeping the costs low and leveling the playing field among employers. Finally, it's the sustainable, proven, effective model that gives all workers an opportunity to earn and count on the benefit from year to year, and makes costs currently borne by both employers and workers more predictable. House File 2 does not create the need for leave. Employers are already dealing with significant costs, as is the state, as Representative Richardson laid out. Employers are, House File 2 just makes those costs more visible, but more importantly, easier to build into both an employer and a family budget. And while the bill provides up to 12 weeks for medical and up to 12 weeks for family leave for serious life events lasting more than 7 days, 30 years of FMLA data and experiences in other states show that workers take what they need, and that is on average far less than the maximum allowed. For example, Massachusetts allows up to 26 weeks, and median leave lengths have been 12. In Washington, the entitlement is 12 to 18 weeks, and the average has been around 7. There is no evidence that Minnesota workers are less committed to their employers or coworkers or more inclined to abuse their benefits than those in other states. In fact, one could argue the opposite. The design of House File 2 sits squarely within the parameters of other states, with not a single major policy element that isn't matched or exceeded by other state programs. For example, we were just talking about leave lengths. As shown here, 5 of the 8 states with operating programs have combined leave entitlements that exceed those in House File 2. I had a couple other slides, but Representative Richardson did an excellent job of laying out both the current gaps in access, as well as the many, many benefits, both to workers, families, and the state. So I will skip those for now and be available for questions later.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Patrick. With that, I will move to the other testifiers. And the first one I have on my list is Assistant Commissioner Kiki Brown. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tiki Brown. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. Paid family and medical leave is one of the best policies we can pursue to support Minnesota families and workers. It will make it easier for Minnesota families to raise a child or care for a sick or aging relative without putting a paycheck at risk. It's good for women and families, and it's a key to financial stability. So many Minnesota families will benefit. Nearly 75% of Minnesota's workforce is left out of paid family leave. It's typically people in working class professions. Studies also show that black, indigenous, people of color workers are less likely to have paid family and medical leave. And the need for paid family and medical leave is greater in rural areas, and access is less. Offering paid family and medical leave also aligns with the work we've done and continue to do so in human services to make our economic assistance programs better at providing economic stability and security to all workers, including the low-income working families served on programs such as MFIB, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, DWP, the Diversionary Workforce Program, and the Child Care Assistance Program. All workers deserve access to paid time off to care for new children, sick, or aging families. Paid family and medical leave will get that done. Thank you.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Brown, for your testimony. Please stay around just in case of any questions. The next person on the list is Kevin Brown, and followed by Mr. John Fallon. Please get close by so you can quickly take the seat.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Brown. I'm the owner of SmartSet, a 37-year-old graphic design and print shop in Northeast Minneapolis. We're a certified B Corp and union shop and members of Metro IBA and Main Street Alliance. On New Year's Day this year, my senior designer, who's been with us for 5 years, had a baby. Like all new moms, she wanted to spend time with her newborn but also continue in her career at SmartSet. We discussed how best to balance these two important goals for her, and before she left, I agreed to pay 3 weeks maternity leave along with her 3 weeks paid vacation, which will allow her to take 6 weeks off and not have to worry about how to pay her bills. This was not an easy thing to do. Paying her as well as her replacement puts a huge financial burden on the company at a critical time of year. Paid family and medical leave funded by a small payroll tax would allow me to keep my labor costs the same while an employee is out on leave. About 8 years ago, my mother died of a sudden heart attack, and because my father had Alzheimer's, we moved him to Minnesota so we could care for him. He would only live 4 more months, and while I would visit him on my lunch hour and after work, I think a lot about what I could have done to take time off and hire replacement staff to take over some of my duties at work. At the time, the business just could not afford this unexpected expense. I will never get back the time I could have spent with my father. The Chamber will tell you how terrible a financial burden this would be on small business owners, but the cost of training a new employee averages $1,800 and is much more in highly skilled jobs like ours. The current system creates higher turnover and increased costs in hiring and training, particularly in today's very tight labor market. Small businesses account for half the jobs in the state of Minnesota and are the biggest creators of new jobs. Yet we compete with the largest corporations in the state for talent, and they are able to offer better benefits because of their larger pool of enrollees. Isn't it time to level the playing field for small businesses and allow owners and employees to take time off for illness and the birth of children? I urge you to support small business and vote in favor of House File 2. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Followed by Mr. Fallon and followed by Dr. Nadia. John? Not yet. Dr. Nadia? Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, I am Nadia Maccabee-Riaboy, and I'm a pediatrician at Children's Hospitals of Minnesota. Most people don't know how common it is for us to see children alone in their hospital rooms, because their parents can't afford to take off work and stay with them. Some kids are hospitalized for weeks or even months. As a doctor, I often call their parents' cell phones each day to update them on their kids' progress because their parents heartbreakingly can't take that time off work to be at their child's bedside. I often walk down the hospital hallways and see these children or babies lonely and crying out for attention. I'll stop into these patients' rooms and offer them a snuggle or a pacifier as I do my physical exam, but my heart aches when the nurses and I have to leave them alone. Not only is it heart-wrenching to see these children missing their parents, but we've found that it takes these children longer to heal. An unmeasured cost of forcing parents back to work when their kids are in the hospital is the cost of prolonging these expensive hospitalizations. As a mother of three, I cannot imagine the impossible choice these parents often have to make between earning money for their family or caring for their ill baby. It is quite obvious at the hospital that families with lower means and jobs that can't be remote are the people who are most often forced to make this impossible choice. It's not just sad, it's unjust. In Minnesota, our choice is clear. We need to pass paid family and medical leave. We need to do better. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Dr. Maccabee Ryboy. The next person I have is John, followed by Stephanie. If you're in the room, John Tronson. Welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, or good afternoon. My name is Jan Tronson, to the committee. I rise today as a patriot and a retired 27-year law enforcement veteran to speak on this bill. I will start with the word power. The bill allows up to 24 weeks for employees to be away from their jobs and receive their wage. With shortage already in the workforce, I ask, where is the trained, qualified workforce to hit the ground running to provide the required daily basis service in our state and city infrastructures, all our life safety inspections required by law, building and safety inspections for construction, field be ripe with delays? Who's going to fill the positions of firefighters in all aspects of law enforcement? All medical positions at our medical centers? Where will we get the CDL drivers for our goods and transportation needs? Close to the home, who will fill all the positions at our group homes, nursing home, and assisted living homes for our senior citizens at what cost? I see the authors of this bill are in the majority, and they do not understand power and its effects. All they see is millions of dollars in our reserves, and they want it. If it passes, the cost of this program will rise every year, and the pass will be passed on to Minnesota employers, consumers, and taxpayers. In closing, as my 27 years in law enforcement, I understand power and have seen how it creates heat and destruction on a daily basis, and that's why it needs to be controlled. I oppose this bill because it's ripe with fraud and abuse, just like the PPE fraud that put the Minnesota in the national news. They will claim this will not happen because we will have oversight. Really? All these people with the oversight exemption are exempt from this bill? When fraud and abuse happens, and it will, the excuse and statement from the state will be, we are short-staffed as a result of this bill. Remember, the knife cuts both ways. If this bill passes, you may be the ones that need to find other resources that will not exist to cover your daycare needs, school needs, medical needs, or aging parent needs. Use your power wisely in this case and do not allow the heat and destruction of this bill that brings financial, destroys financial of businesses, citizens, and the quality of life. Please vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Tronson. Stephanie. Stephanie Stossel. Phil Griffin will be the next person. Please get, close by. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Stephanie Stasel. I live in St. Paul, and I'm a leader in Isaiah. I think most Minnesotans, if not all, want to take care of themselves or a loved one during a time of sickness or death. As a teacher in St. Paul Public Schools, I was able to take the last 2 weeks of accrued leave to go of the school year to go help my mother take care of my father who was dying. I ended up living with my parents for 2 months before my father passed away. I am single and my sole income earner, and I would not have been financially able to do that for 2 months. But I know I would have tried, because not being with my parents during that time was not a real option. How does a daughter turn away from her parents in their time of need? She does not. Minnesotans want real options, options that make them or their loved ones a top priority and will not put their family in financial risk. We say family values are our priority. Please let's act on that. Support paid family medical leave for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Thistle. And so next person is Mr. Griffin, followed by Jim. If you can get back. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, and Representative Richardson. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. My name is Phil Griffin. I work for Ewell Consulting, and I'm here today representing the Best Life Alliance. Excuse me. As you know, the Best Life Alliance is a statewide coalition made up of more than 130 waiver service provider organizations for people with disabilities, their families, and supporters. As a coalition, we want to applaud your efforts to institute a paid family leave program in Minnesota. However, we do need to express our very sincere concerns about the significant financial challenges this program will bring to the disability waiver service providers and their patients. When disability providers are already extremely low reimbursement rates and the program is being very, very stressed, we need your help in trying to deal with what will eventually pass in this legislation. Our workforce is overwhelmingly women, and we do try to offer robust wages and benefits as is possible, but with 95% plus of our reimbursement coming from the Medicaid program, it is up to you to fund through the Disability Waiver Service System the cost of this program. I understand that we often classify things as either for or against when we're talking about legislation, and it's much more nuanced than that in this situation. This is complicated, and you cannot just classify somebody as in favor or opposed. We support your intent, but we need the funding for DWRS to survive its implementation. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. If there are questions, we'd be happy to answer them. We look forward to working with the author and all of you as this moves through the process. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I see Jim is waiting to sit down. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. And will be followed by Dr. Hannah Litzin.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Jim Kaczmarzynski. I own a construction company in Rochester, Minnesota, Drywall Services of Rochester. I'm here to speak against proposed Bill HF2. Businesses have already struggled through the COVID restrictions. Why would it be necessary to compound it even more with burdensome legislation? Just recently, you passed laws to ban fossil fuels completely by the year 2040. Currently, we have enough solar power and wind energy to accommodate approximately 6 to 10% of our power in this state. It took 60 years for us to get to that point. Without an active and 100% involved workforce, how do you intend to accomplish the work required to get us to 100% sustainable electricity in 17 years?
To the testifier, please stay within the realms of the bill, which is the paid...
I'm there. What is going to happen when a contractor has hard deadlines to meet and they suddenly lose their project manager? When a business has built a team and spent time and resources developing people in positions of responsibility, to allow them to simply go home for 6 months is not feasible. Who is going to be responsible for the deficits realized by these employers as a result? Do you realize how damaging that will be to Minnesota businesses? Now, I understand that from time to time people need to be home to assist someone who needs their help, but I believe this program will be rife with fraud. When employees are experienced at how to game and milk this system, They are going to put themselves in a category of individuals who will be identified as uncommitted and ultimately unproductive employees. You are setting people up to fail in life. They will be shunned by prospective employers, thereby minimizing their ability to provide for themselves or their families. If you say that Minnesotans have a superior work ethic and that the majority would not exploit this option, then why is this necessary in the first place?
Thank you.
Why do you need to stick to $1 billion into this boondoggle?
I didn't want to cut you off. Can you please wrap up your testimony?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Dr. Hannah Litzin, if you're around, welcome to the committee, and we'll proceed. As I've told everyone, we've got 2 minutes. If Dr. Hannah isn't in, we have Casey McGregor. Welcome to the committee, and please proceed with your testimony.
Hello, I'm Casey McGregor from Rochester. HF2 is an American dream-killing bill. I encourage you to go and listen to my other two testimonies. I do not take enjoyment in sharing my personal information. It is the only way I know how to effectively communicate with you. I'm not trying to compete with anybody or compare lived life experiences. We all have our own truths in this world. Those of you that are speaking in favor of this bill, I can relate and empathize with you. I shattered my ankle. A few months later, my 22-day-old nephew died, and I missed a lot of work. I came back after these moments in life, and I had to survive, so I have an $18,000 HELOC. As I was crawling back onto my feet, 3 months later, my best friend, 42, went into hospice with ovarian cancer. As I was sitting in her hospice room as she was dying, Governor Walz closed my business. I understand what it's like to be without income. I now have a $33,000 SBA loan because my PPP loan got based off of the worst year of my life. And I still absolutely oppose HF2 as it kills the American dream. Do you realize what you're compensating and giving up? So you stay home for 24 weeks with your baby, but your husband, brother, sister, mother all lose their jobs within 3 to 5 years because it'll take a while for the $1 billion to run out before the uncapped percentage goes too high. I wonder if that's going to happen after the next election cycle. Trade school professions do not have a pool of people they can just come and fill in. Mechanic, welder, farmer, hairstylist, spa, egg mechanic, housing electrician, carpenter, etc. The list is long. As businesses, you can't be without. And if you hire a second person to do the work while the first person is out, now they come back and the company has to pay two people for one job or pay unemployment. Either way, this hurts the business. If you can't tell my voice, I'm having some health issues. I might need surgery on my vocal cords. And I would myself, personally, rather lose everything that I have built for 22 years than this bill get established and destroy businesses. The heart of the state of Minnesota is small businesses. HF2 is fool's gold. It looks all shiny and great, but the damage does not discriminate. All small businesses, red, blue, or purple, will close. It is a myth that people will not take advantage of this, as this has never been done before. No other state has 24 weeks. The average of 8 weeks, because people come back to save their PTO and for their money. Having 24 weeks paid doesn't incentivize anybody to come back.
Mr. McGregor, if you can wrap up your testimony.
Vote no on HF2. Sorry. It kills Minnesotans' dreams. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I have Reverend Friedman Ellis, followed by Elena Niehoff, and the last but not the least is Margaret on the list. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor, members of the committee, Representative Richardson. My name is Corinne Friedman Ellis, and I am a pastor by trade and training, though my vocation currently is as a full-time parent to my 4.5-year-old and 1.5-year-old. As a minister and a person of faith, I believe every person deserves the dignity of paid family and medical leave, and as a Minnesotan, I believe we can do it. Minnesotans are resilient. We make it work, and we don't complain. But I'm going to complain on behalf of my fellow Minnesotans. We are bearing the full cost of our caring and our healing, and we shouldn't have to. I was lucky to have paid leave available when I gave birth to both of my children, but I never anticipated what would happen next. Diagnoses for both of them with the same chronic illness, one that limits their diets and requires regular surgical procedures to monitor. I left the workforce to focus on their health, and I'm proud to say that they're both thriving, thanks to excellent medical professionals and a lot of grit on their part. But most parents with chronically ill children don't have this luxury. Paid family and medical leave would help not just after the birth of a baby, but also for parents like me who find themselves unexpectedly thrown into a complex medical system. Paid family and medical leave touches all our lives, and there should be no carve-outs in this policy for those on public assistance or those struggling most to make ends meet. I urge you to pass paid family and medical leave this session so that all Minnesota families can thrive. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Reverend. So the next person is Ms. Niehoff. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Elena Niehoff. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. I speak in opposition to Bill HF-02. This bill seems to be a textbook exercise on how to destroy small businesses in Minnesota. The added cost and complexities this will add to already overburdened and struggling businesses here in Minnesota. It will have disastrous results. This bill will force businesses to decide whether to close their doors or leave the state. Or worse, it may force businesses to discriminate against those that would benefit from this program. The surplus money that you are planning to use for this program must go back to those who paid it in. Creating another big government program with this temporary money will only create future budgetary burdens after the surplus runs out. What then? Increase the taxes? If this bill passes, it will create yet another big government program that will never go away. If this bill passes, it will only increase stresses to an already toxic business culture in the state. Further, this bill is especially dangerous to the small businesses. Large corporate interests in this state may be able to deal with the labor pool challenges and added costs that this legislation will surely cause, where the small businesses will not. Please vote no on Bill HF-02. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I have Margaret as the last testifier on the bill. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Margaret Sitta. I'm a high school counselor, a member of the West St. Paul Federation of Teachers, and a parent. I'm here to speak in support of House File 2. As you can likely see, I am 38 weeks pregnant. I'm going to give birth in the next few days, so this is personal to me. I have lived and am living the experience of being a Minnesotan without paid family and medical leave protections. The lobbying from educational leadership organizations against paid family and medical leave is disappointingly short-sighted and disingenuous. Educators are disproportionately female, and lack of paid family and medical leave disproportionately harms women, especially women of color. There's a desperate need in education for staff retention, and paid family medical leave has been demonstrated to increase retention. And at its core, the argument that the greater good is for a teacher to be in the classroom suffering rather than taking the time they need to heal or care for a family member is inhumane. Teachers already schedule their lives around student needs and the school calendar as much as possible. A colleague of mine was recently diagnosed with cancer and expressed disappointment that their doctor didn't want them to wait until June to have an essential surgery. By definition, anyone eligible for family medical leave needs the leave. An employer's glossing over the effect on the employee to emphasize the effect on their bottom line are being callous at best. Even childbirth, which is often a desired and celebrated life event, is also a physical trauma, and newborn care is all-consuming. This is my third pregnancy. My first baby was stillborn in 2019, and while I had some accrued sick time, I took only 5 days off, three of which I spent in the hospital, and returned to work the next week. If you've given birth, you might remember the physical experience of being 1 week postpartum. If you've experienced stillbirth, you know I was not physically or emotionally ready to return to work. But because I knew I would run out of accrued time if I was fortunate to have future pregnancies and living babies, I returned to work, suffering. I've worked in my school district for 10 years, I've been careful with my sick days, and I still do not have enough accrued leave time to take even the 9 weeks I'm planning to take with this baby. Paid family and medical leave would give all Minnesotans, educators included, the time they need to properly heal and return to work ready to focus on work. As a stillbirth parent, I just want to emphasize also how critical it is stillbirth remain in the definition of pregnancy in this bill. The recovery time is as necessary for stillbirth parents as it is for the parents of living babies. I urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony and congratulations to you and your family. So with that, members, we have a few minutes of discussion on the bill. We'll start with Representative Baker.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. Apologize for being a little late today. Representative Richardson, I think I want to start by saying the testimony today is really powerful, and I think that what we're hearing is a lot of need for some reasonable stuff that people are really searching for. I think Margaret, our last testifier, she's going to have a baby any day. I don't think there's many people in this room that do not want to give her that time off. I applaud what you're trying to do, Representative Richardson, with this bill. I think that what we are at a point now, Mr. Chair and members, is I don't think we have any amendments today. We're not trying to play the games about how we can offer things up. Do we have any amendments today? I don't think we do, no. So, but we're at a point in the session and the journey of this bill. This is the third time I've heard this bill, and I get a lot of the passion on both sides of this issue. And I think the folks that are really concerned about this, that we brought up before, are concerned about the fiscal cost of where this is. And I know we have a fiscal note on this for this committee, Mr. Chair and members. I know this is our slice of it, right? This is our small piece of it. There's a lot more to this, and we're a finance committee, so we should talk about that if this is a finance question that we have. The part I think that I want to spend a little extra time on, if I may, Mr. Chair, is the need for us to slow this down, the need for us to really engage in what does a bill look like that we can sort of get behind that still accomplishes a lot of the goals we want to get to, so Margaret can still take 12 weeks off. Because I will tell you, in the real world of business, we get that. We understand. As an employer myself, I understand this. The problems that we're having now is, and I'm seeing this, this is about the third time I've seen this in committee. I know it's got other stops. But it's heating up. It's getting more intense because people are getting more afraid of it either maybe not passing or passing the way it's being presented. So what I'm asking today is for our committee to table the bill for a second. Just think about pausing this bill, not because I want to see it not keep moving, but what's happening right now is business owners, managers who are running nursing homes, who are trying to look at the bill and the language that's in it by looking at, you hear everybody saying 24 weeks. I get that's not going to happen all the time, right? I know that, but it's in the bill, and we shouldn't have it in the bill that way. And I had a very good meeting with you yesterday. And I am very earnest about clearing my schedule to work alongside of you to make a bill work that accomplishes a lot of what we want to do here. But we have got to identify some things that are dividing our state on this bill, that are dividing the business community, and they're throwing information out there that is in the bill so they can do that, but we got to slow it down so we can get maybe some better and more accurate, maybe some collaboration so that we can see these are areas that we should focus on. And I think that, you know, we just need to, we need to do the bills that we just did before I got here. Representative Edelson had a great bill. I would have supported it. We need to focus on reimbursements. We need to focus on getting people more money in those jobs right now. I am all about that. But what we're also doing on the same, on the other hand, is we're bringing this massive bill forward.
Vic, I just wanted to get a confirmation. Are you moving a motion to table the bill, which is non-debatable?
Yes, Mr. Chair, let's do that. Okay, do you want to do that now or one later?
To the motion, because you brought a motion, it's non-debatable. So let's, the motion before us by Representative Baker is to table HF 2. And
Mr. Chair, yeah, I just want to have a roll call on it, but I hope we have more
roll call
more
being requested. A roll call will be called by the flag. So I move to the motion. Now, the first, I say nay, so the clerk will take the roll.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, will we have more discussion before we take the roll?
Cause it's non-debatable, so we okay, go directly thank you. To the roll call. The chair votes no.
Chair, no. Vice Chair Bonner?
No.
Representative Baker?
Aye.
Representative Clardy?
No.
Representative Fisher?
No.
Representative Franson?
Yes.
Representative Gilman?
Yes.
Representative Hicks?
No.
Representative Keeler?
No.
Representative Cotiza Watoon?
No.
Representative Pryor?
No.
Representative Plum?
Yes.
Representative Ryer?
No.
Representative Zelisnikar?
Yes.
I think with five ayes and nine nays, the motion to table does not prevail. We go back to Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the conversation on this. And again, I don't want to, and I know reality is we're not going to kill this bill. But we have got to start talking honestly about how can we bring the issues of workforce to this important issue that Representative Richardson is trying to solve. Businesses want to be a part of this conversation. We, I think, are very motivated to figure this out. But to start coming out of a brand new program that is very large, that a lot of us have we're trying to get our head around the size of it and the scope of it. But putting the stackability out of the gate is a lot. I want to see people like Margaret have her baby and have 3 months off. That, I think, is there's nothing wrong with that. And there are times when you need to have a family that is in need and you need some time off. Stacking them in a calendar year is a real issue. And I know that people don't ask for those timelines to line up, but it's a reality, though, that we've got to deal with because we don't have any workers. This isn't a time when we have people ready to come to work. We are lucky to get two applications for a job where we used to get 8 or 10. It's just different today. We all know this. Let's focus on reimbursements. Let's focus on filling these slots with better pay where we can do this. And I'm just asking, and I want to walk alongside Representative Richardson, if she would allow me to help, to work on this, to find out some matters that have been done in other states. Like, again, nobody has taken employees down to one employee. The other states have done five employees and up. There's a reason for that. There's a reason our federal partners with their federal paid family leave is that 50 employees and up are paid, but not below that. There's reasons why people have really dove into that, and the size of a business matters. Seasonal businesses matter. And again, there's just a lot of things that we need to work on. So, members, again, I know we're gonna pass some kind of a bill, And to the people out there that think we just don't want to do anything, that is not going to happen. But we have to do a bill in Minnesota that makes sense, that we can manage, that will not hurt workforce more than you might think it will. Because as an employer, I promise you, by taking some 12 weeks or more out for certain positions is really going to be something that we've never had before. But we can do better. And I think that if we really get serious about collaborations, if we get serious about sitting down, the sooner we do it, the better. Because it's making Minnesotans extremely nervous. They're making decisions about the future of their expansions and what are they going to do. And this right now needs to be done now, not in May. So appreciate your time, members and Mr. Chair and Rep. Richardson. I stand ready to help in any way that you need me or want me. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Beck. I think this bill has been around and we've discussed it in three times that I've been here. We'll have more discussions as we go around. So the next person I have, Representative Ryan. Did you have? Please, what? I have Representative Zelesnikar.
Thank you, Chair. And you know, I was looking at the data that was done by the University of Minnesota. And I think one of the things I just want members here to process is that Forbes did an article. The University of Minnesota talks about the states that have family paid time off. And I wanted to see what's happening in those states. June of 2022, Forbes lists New York as the highest tax state, one that's doing this. Minnesota's fifth on the highest taxed out of 50, and California ranks ninth. Forbes also did a 2023 of states that have the highest numbers of people leaving the state. Guess where Minnesota is? We're at eighth out of 50. California's number one, New York's two, Massachusetts five, all states that are referenced in this. So what is my point? We need to learn from what's happening in other states and learn from the big picture, because what my concern is we're talking about adding more programs for employers. I don't know how many at the table or in this room have been an employer, but I have. And I don't know how many have ran 24-hour facilities. But this isn't an option of a four-day work week for a 24-hour facility. This isn't an option of shutting the door and having them go to another place. If these bills go forth, the reality of it is the 12 weeks and the 24 weeks total we're talking about, that's a short-term gap. And in the meantime, we're going to implode nursing homes, assisted livings, home care providers. So families are going to need to save all their money, not divest assets, save it all, because you're going to end up caring for those people who need 24-hour care 365 days a week in the state of Minnesota, because there will not be providers if we follow the trends. And so do we want a long-term stable provider group? Because if we do, this is going to be the final nail in the coffin. Because it isn't about wanting to do this. It isn't about thinking an idea is okay. What is sustainable? It is the cost of paying for the employee, but it's also the cost of filling another shift. And if you look at what's happened through COVID, when we did all the mandates, we shut down businesses, all of the assisted livings and nursing homes were flying in people from around the country, from pool agency, paying $50, $75 for an aide. And guess what? Now those costs are getting passed on to everybody. And who's the getting passed on to? And we're not talking about schools and counties and state and all the government. Those costs are going to be paid by everybody in this room, including us at the table. We're taxpayers. There is no magic money tree. So it's going to come from somebody. So I urge us to just understand, this isn't a matter of principle. Is it a great idea? We have Representative Baker said, we got to find a long-term sustainable plan. Otherwise, we will go back to the time of when my grandma rotated her mom. I take her 1 month, you take her the next month. That's what we're going to have, because there will not be providers. I have talked to them. I have met with them in the community for the last 3 weeks, and I'm meeting with them again tomorrow. And they are on credit lines, and banks are going to call notes. And when that happens, it's going to be a dark day, for disability groups, for assisted living groups, and for nursing homes. And it's not something I'm making up. I've talked to many people, and there's many people in this room, and that's just one industry. So we're not going to be talking about 12 weeks or 24. It's going to be long-term holes for society, and I hope you think about it.
Thank you so much. Representative Richardson, did you want to respond briefly? Or Ms. Fitzpatrick?
thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I appreciate the opportunity. And I'll start with Representative Baker. I think we also had a really great conversation as well, and looking forward to continued conversations. We know that this bill will continue to change and refine as it moves. And as I stated with you, my commitment to continue to work with you as well. As we get to this place, and as someone who has run a 24-hour facility, I also know that my staff in those facilities face these really difficult questions about caring for themselves and having to choose between a paycheck and caring for themselves or a family member. And what I would see happen in those cases is that they would opt out of the workforce. And I think that we have to acknowledge that the challenges that we're having from a workforce perspective, they're complex reasons that our workforce is the way that it is. Prior to the COVID pandemic, we were projecting huge deficits in the numbers of direct service providers, over 50,000 of them prior to COVID. So this is not a new issue. This is something that we've been struggling with as a state. And we know that low wages are a contributing factor to that. And we also know that when you have smaller businesses, they don't have the ability to compete with larger businesses as well. So what we also have before us is an opportunity to have a little bit of a leveling of a playing field. There is a war on talent that is happening right now, and the stories that I've heard over the last 3 years that I've been carrying this bill, and I know others have been working on this bill for the past 8 years, so this is not new in terms of the debate that's been happening, but also what we've been hearing about people leaving the communities that they love because they can't get access to paid family and medical leave, people putting off having children because they don't have access to paid family and medical leave, or people making the decision that they're going to leave the workforce because there's nowhere to take their child. So I think that we can agree that there's a lot of complex issues at play. And it sounds like we can also agree that when someone is seriously ill, they should be able to care for themselves and not choose between caring for themselves and a paycheck as well. So looking forward to continued conversation as we move through the bill.
Mr. Spatton, do you want to respond? Thank you. The next person on the list is Representative Cotizo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks again, Representative Richardson. I've seen the bill before, not only this biennium, but in the previous two biennium. And I find it interesting, and maybe somebody can refresh my memory, but when we were in a different situation the past two biennium, when there was this bill introduced in the Senate, I don't know if that bill ever got a hearing. Do you happen to know if this paid family and medical leave bill, either that you carried or that Chair Halverson carried, previously got a hearing in the Senate over the last two biennium?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Cazizo Watun, for the question. When I was carrying the bill, no, I don't recall that it received a hearing. I do recall that there was a different bill that was introduced within the Senate.
Thank you for that. I want to make sure that we ground ourselves, because this bill has been being worked on almost a decade. Other states have introduced programs like this. When we bring ideas to the forefront, and all the conversations that you've had and the conversations that Chair Halverson had on this bill with the chamber, with our friends on the other side of the aisle, we have been working on these issues behind the scenes and taking input and making changes. I just want to make sure that, you know, when we have the opportunity to move on something and that something gets its time due, that we actually are able to have the conversations. We're seeing that in Democrat-led bodies. This bill was proposed in a Republican-held Senate biennium after biennium, and it never even received a hearing. So now that we have the opportunity to have the discussion and have it out and move forward on a program that could work for Minnesotans and work for small business owners, now our friends across the aisle want to slow it down even more. And it's just very frustrating. It's frustrating as somebody who recently had a baby. You know, we look at the statistics. It's like it's less than 2% of cases or claims that a pregnant person has to take a health care leave for themselves, like the sick care, or not sick care, you know, the personal care leave, and then have their bonding leave with their baby after that. So that's like pretty much the only situation in which somebody would take 24 weeks of leave back to back, as well as I'm understanding the bill. So if you could maybe shed some light on if there's other situations that I'm not thinking of, somebody, if a parent were to get cancer and then, you know, something happened to their child later in the year where they took 12 weeks, you know, in February through May, and then from October, November, December, or something along those lines, it maybe would be split. The chances of something happening like that where it's back-to-back, I just think are really slim, and I really would like to ground folks in the rarity and the dire situations in which that would happen.
Chair Noor, Representative Katizawatoon, yes, the data from other states suggests that is a very rare situation, and the vast majority of situations where someone is taking both types of leave in 1 year is related to pregnancy. Very, very small percentage in the states that we can look at that have both types of leave. And again, as I mentioned in my presentation, there are 5 states that have even longer combined leave entitlements. And this is not, that is not a common that they're taking for both types of leave.
The next person on the list is Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the people in the audience and that might be watching or listening, there's a great deal of data that you'll see before the members on this. And hopefully you can see the copies and download and read it. I did notice that in the abridged presentation of the larger document of that we've got, that on slides 4 and 5 there's a discrepancy about Washington, in that on the one it says allows 12 to 18 weeks, and on figure 5 it says the maximum is 16. So it'd be nice if we could actually get what the actual number is in the real data, because it makes us you know, less assured in trusting the data when there's discrepancies in the actual presentation reports. And then I noticed on the slide 4, in one it says average is, you know, for Washington, the other one is median is 12 weeks. You know, if the median is 12, that means that over half are 12 or more weeks. Average gives us a better understanding, but when a presentation switches between average and median, that also causes a little bit of consternation. And, you know, I see the median as 12, meaning that the vast majority have used the equivalent of the max of one of the two options, and that I don't know if from there up they use the max of both options. So if we could maybe at least get a little clarity, and then offline we can get some updated, corrected presentations.
I'm not a mathematician, but I know that the median means the middle, so I will let Ms. Fitzpatrick, who drafted the document plus the presentation, to respond to that.
Thank you, Chair Noor, members of the committee. I'm happy to take it offline as well. So I'll just briefly say the data that's on the slide that I presented today is from the most recent data. The report in your packet is from 2019. And then in terms of the Washington, there's a 2-week bump for a pregnancy-related complication. So that is not reflected in that particular figure that you mentioned, so that was the 12 to 18 weeks. The median number comes from Massachusetts, and it's because that's the way they present their data. So to some degree, we are beholden to the way the states present the data that they have on how their programs are operating. So in that case, and then just to remind people that the maximum leave entitlement in Massachusetts, combined leave entitlement in Massachusetts, is 26 weeks. So again, I think that the median is challenging for the reasons that you outline, and I would prefer an average myself, but I am beholden to the data that is made available to us. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, that's why we don't know, the median is the middle. We don't know if everything above the middle is 26 weeks. It's hard to gauge. And part of that is, and both were in the same presentation, now I understand that you're taking and presenting stuff from different reports. But if I look on page 12 of the one larger document report, it indicates that current modeling, there's 13.4% of Minnesota workers are taking family or medical leave in a calendar year, and that's under the current circumstances of unpaid or if the employer has a paid version of it. And then it's calculating it would increase to 15%. That's 1.6% delta with doing this new program. And from the years of debating this, it's going to be several hundred. One estimate was given 300 in one department, but several hundred FTEs in order to administer something that would have an effect of 1.6%. And that gets back to one of the committee members stated, well, the Senate didn't have this exact bill. This is the fourth engrossment. Generally, when bills pass and become law, the Senate and the House versions aren't identical. Then we either agree that, yes, the other chamber had the better one, or they agree that we had the better one, or we have a conference committee is the normal procedure. So it's not at all shocking or unusual to have differences between the chambers on the bills. But if it's as large of a endeavor, it would happen during when 1.5 million MA qualifications are being redone because the expiration of the federal pandemic emergency would kick out. There's a lot of activity overlapping and bringing up this substantial process and program during an overlapping time where there's going to be a strong hurtful load already for the agencies. That might be why some of us are saying, well, let's look at a tweak or a less dramatic change. And I think that's where the conversation is. It's not all or nothing. Government usually means we come together and we come up with what's most workable and doable, and maybe have a transition and see. So I would hope that the author would talk with Representative Baker and others, and we could come up with a more completely advantageous route of implementing this that would avoid some disturbances in the workforce. The other thing is, data-wise, looking at all these tables, over the last couple of years, well, during the COVID, the workforce participation and the indicators and shifting in behavioral dynamics, so actuarial calculations need to be redone to effectively understand the implications of this bill and the assumptions that are being made. And I think that some of the data we're using or referring to is not quite up to date or accurate enough for us to do this large of a endeavor without further debate and discussion.
Just wanted to remind members to keep their statements brief. By 2:30, we'll have to vote this bill out. So I have Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Representative Katiza Watoon's comment of you've been taking input and making changes, I would ask then why is this bill still so very controversial within the business community? Just because an idea has been around for 10 or more years does not mean it's still a good idea or ready for prime time. And based on the feedback that I have been getting, this bill is still not ready for prime time. Now, I understand it's going through the committee process, but I do not believe too many of the Republicans' amendments have been taken in other committees. It will go to the floor. Republicans, again, will offer a boatload of committees. You will all vote them down. In the Senate, it will be the same way, so you can avoid a conference committee. Minnesota, some of you were here, most of you were not, when we put MNsure into place. That premium tax was not supposed to go above 1.5%. It has never seen or has never been below 3.5%. Republicans, we like to go with the marketplace. What is the market demanding? I, as a employee, I'm looking for a job, may ask my future employer as I'm job seeking, what benefits do you provide? If that benefit package is not liked, I may continue looking elsewhere. And conservatives, we just tend to do that. Well, this works for me, it doesn't work for me. We don't demand that we change the culture because we don't like something at that moment. For some reason, Democrats, if they don't like something, they got to use the force of the law to come behind people. And it's always, it seems to be these days, the business community. Well, they're not doing it the way we want to, so we're gonna use the force of the law. Where Republicans are just like, well, if I don't like it, I'll just go somewhere else. I'm very concerned about how this is going to affect our long-term care. If you've read what's in the fiscal note here, you know, it says employers, including nursing homes, may but are not required to deduct 50% of the premium from an employee's wages. Now, I don't know about you, but all we've been hearing for the last, 3 years is that nursing homes are in needing of money and that the workers themselves are needing an increase. And here, we're going to allow homes to deduct from the wages of the employees, and I'm not upset at that because there is a cost of doing business, and the nursing homes aren't going to be able to survive with yet another mandate, another tax. We just, in this body, last week, I think it was, or was it the week before? They all blend together. This is week 7. That's about all I know. This body voted to have taxpayers pay for lunch and breakfast because parents couldn't afford the $2 or $3 a day to feed their kids. And now we're saying, hey, we're going to go ahead and take some more money out of your paycheck, people, so that we can pay for this new entitlement program. So I'm very concerned about how this is going to go. So far, this body, the House of Representatives, has voted to send $1,280,434 out the door. It looks like, if my math is correct, of that dollar amount, $555,975,000 was just for fiscal year 24-25. And in this bill, it appears that we're going to be sending $1.7 billion just for seed money to start up this program. And we have not even begun to pass a bill out of this committee so that we can fund our nursing homes, so that we can fund our disability communities. And they're asking me, when is it our turn? So I don't know. I'm just disappointed. I'm very disappointed. Thank you.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. quick question for the author of the bill. So if an employer cannot fill the vacancy while someone's using the this program, does this bill compensate them for the lost sales or lower production? That's my question.
Representative Briggs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. What the bill does is it provides an opportunity that if an individual is going to be out of work because they are seriously ill, caring for a seriously ill family member, or caring for a new young one, it provides that they would receive wage replacement as they are out on leave, and that would allow the employer to be able to use what they would typically be paying that person for wages in order to find someone who could come in during that time period when someone is out. If an individual works for a small business, there are technical assistance and financial incentives that would be available the way that the bill is the bill is currently written to help support the leave of someone being out. But I also think it's important to recognize that if you have an individual who is seriously ill, if someone needs, we heard the examples of cancer treatments and other things, they're not going to be at work. And so understanding that as a business owner, there are going to be times that you have to cover for individuals is part of doing business.
All right, so I'll just share a little bit about me really quick. I am a business owner alongside my husband and his brother and my sister-in-law. This business has been around since 1966. We supply not only the entire Midwest, several states in the Midwest, but up into Canada. And we are just under 50 employees. We're really blessed. But a third of our day and our lives are spent with our coworkers. And what's just disheartening and frustrating is when we hear about small business versus big business, you know, we're all doing life together. And I feel as a business owner, the opportunity that is already on the market, I can leverage what we do and what we sell and what we provide as a product because our great team as an opportunity to you know, incentivize them. We use it as leveraging when we're hiring. We incentivize employees with their time off as part of their wage. We create a great working environment. And what's hard to hear is when you talk about these rare instances of people abusing the system. The problem that I see, not only for my business, but other manufacturers, not only of products that we get, but that we sell, is it's not only lost sales for my family, it's for all of our employees, it's for all of our dealers, all of our vendors, and there's nobody that will come in that can do as good a job. So as an employer, we work. This is what's great about owning a business, is we work with our employees to make a great environment. And not everybody does, like Rep. Franzen was talking about, not everybody does have that. It depends on what they choose as a profession. But the majority of people in Minnesota, especially business owners, step up to the plate and they meet people where they're at. Now, we're seeing this and hearing this from real data, and I'm very concerned about my mother-in-law who's in long-term care, who's got dear, sweet people that are sticking around the clock to work hard to take care of and to be a safe place for our loved ones. And I'm surprised if this has been such, I'm brand new to this job, I'm grateful and humbled for this opportunity, but I'm surprised this isn't house file number one, that this is house file number two. The reason we are getting packets and data and all this information and trying to slow down the process is because it is not great how it is right now. And it, you know, we can throw all these numbers around, but I'm very, very concerned that that us as a legislation here can sit and make bigger government without taking into consideration, do we want to have Minnesota be competitive and have economic growth? Because our competitiveness in having a business here in Minnesota where I could hop across the border and bring my company and find new people to work there, those will look more appealing. It's a mass exodus of people leaving Minnesota, and I'm concerned that if we pass House File 2 as it stands, we will see issues across the board, and we'll be sitting here trying to fund 300 more full-time employees to fix the mess that can happen from as it stands right now. So, thank you.
With that, I renew my motion that House File 2 be re-referred to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Say no.
No.
No. The motion prevails. The motion prevails. House File 2 is now re-referred to the Commerce Committee. Members, with no further agenda items before us, we are now adjourned.